Blog Talk Radio.
Each other again. You found the Sonic Home Companion, and I'm your host for the next hour, Dale Graham, Brother Dale Graham, to those who notice the type of thing. It's the 280th day of the year. We're here in this part of the world. We're in the midst of a beautiful fall weather. Here we have the poetry of the seasons, all of the deciduous trees turn color. It's really something to amaze anybody, I think. I want to thank you for your increasing support. Crowd out there has doubled in the past couple of weeks, so thank you very much. I'm a big fan of yours, that's for sure. I couldn't do this show without you. I need some advice from you, as usual. I want to share a little bit of some of those facts that I want you to work into the conversation when you're talking to the youngins over the next week. Did you know? Here's some things to give us some context. The world is the same circumference as it always was. And I say that knowing that, yes, things are, the physicists will immediately turn away from this conversation because they know that that's, there's a pulse to everything. But just put it into some context. We're able to do things that our forefathers never could just vaguely imagine. It was only the most foresighted that would speculate. And we find these in books of fantasy and science fiction. And some of the early writings by the Sufis, people that were considered, to have the ability to see beyond the physical. We refer to that, of course, as the metaphysical. And so some of a large part of what we know, comes from writings and artifacts. Given the choice between reading an old manuscript and hammer and brush, going through archival digs, we may have a fascination with the archival digs if you're an archaeologist, of course. But we still, I think, would prefer the artifacts that gave us the most information. Certainly the written word does. So we're into the evolution of everything that went on before us. It's evolved. That just simply means that it's changed and adapted, I guess. And human beings being the curious creatures that we are, we've had the capacity to question. Those questions never seem to end. We want to know answers to questions about the unknown, as well as learning and discovering whether we know enough about the things that we've taken for granted. Yeah. If one of Apple's products the iPhone. The iPhone had its own company. No computers, no iPads, nothing. Just iPhone. It would be bigger by revenue than McDonald's and Coca-Cola combined. Do you know that? So the complication, of course, now for Apple and other corporations, Google and things like that, is they're being chased around to pay their fair share of taxes. The movement, the protest movements that occurred around the world 3 or 4 years ago, really brought underlined this notion. One of the complications, and perhaps it's a little harsh to say it's a failing of capitalism, but capitalism, like anything else, was an experiment. It has its benefits, but it also has a downside. And one of those downsides that we're discovering is these multinationals that would go bring their business, their headquarters, offshore, meaning somewhere else, where they could get tax concessions. And what it did was it left this consumer market. You know, they had access to consumers, but they weren't paying tax. Now, governments don't run on thin air, and I know this is a sensitive area, but it's only sensitive if you don't have any notion that things cost money. The kind of lifestyle that we have here costs money. And there is no question for anybody that's benefited from it, lived in this experience, that it is worthwhile. So these big multinationals are being chased down through the courts, and they're going to be expected to, through legislation, to pay their fair share. Unprecedented, you say? Overdue, you say? Yeah. A century ago, 20% of the world's population, now we're at about 7.3 billion people, 20% lived in cities. By 2010, that had risen to more than 50% around the whole world. And it will have reached two-thirds by 2050. The truth of the matter is, you know, whether we're developing nations or undeveloped nations, we have modern technology that means we are able to do more with fewer people. We don't need as many people to crop a field as we did 100 years ago. Anybody insincere might say that was wrong for a farmer to buy a better tractor or a newer combine. Give your head a shake. Stoop labor, that's somebody working very hard to feed you and me. And God bless them, they can use what tools they needed. They were given chemicals without them being properly tested and suffered from it. And then there were laws put in to offer protections for people. Chemical companies held culpable. One of my grandfathers died from it. Early sprays, crop sprays. And there was no notion of protections. And he died of cancer. Anybody held responsible for that? Nah, of course not. Foolish old farmer. Did you know the language we use? At least 1,700 words that we use in everyday English were invented by Shakespeare. Yeah. Eyeball. I didn't know that. Excitement. Even sanctimonious. Yeah. So thank you, Bill. In 2012, Cuba spent almost... here we go. Why? This is like an eye-opener. Cuba spent almost 13% of its gross national income on education. The highest proportion in the world. This is just remarkable. That's 2012. The United Kingdom spent 5.8%. This is information from the World Bank. Quality of life indicators place Canada fifth on the list. I think the first is Norway, and the second is Sweden, and then I think Switzerland is fourth. What's the third? It'll come to me. Not Finland. Finland's down about 29th. Canada is holding up there. Well, overall quality of life. Although tropical rainforests cover less than 7% of the Earth's surface, they are home to approximately 50% of the world's living things. You know? Talk about rights. New Zealand was the first country to give women the vote. 1893, all adult women, both indigenous, Maori, and those of European descent, were enfranchised. Yeah. Interesting times we live in. Just when you think you've got it figured out and there's some atrocity, is that really the news that is useful? If you probe, you'll find some really amazing discoveries and connections, positive interaction between our fellow citizens. That in itself does change our attitude. And remember, we're largely a product of the media. People and me, the generation of born with television, it's gone from being a fascination, you know, that replaced radio in the 40s, to being something that portrays a lot of useless garbage and sensationalist viewing that is referred to as news. A lot of it is disturbing, and how much of it is truthful is really in the eye of the beholder. What we need, of course, are people that are able to think through for themselves about the accuracy of the information. Is there any political spin or military censorship going on? Of course there is. Easy to keep us off balance and refer to those kind of attitudes as cynical. Easier to do that than to deal with the reality that we have to be cautious about what we take in. And when we start to believe something holus bolus, well, you know, usually ends up some type of farce, some type of folly. I need you to think of yourselves in a different way today. You know, I want to share some ideas that came about protectors, you and I. I'll start by just declaring that I've discovered, much to my chagrin, yesterday being my birthday, and it was the big one, and I've discovered that I'm akin to the ancients. You know that process about the modernizing of the constitution, of the ritual that went on. You've had a little snippet of that in your background. Well, I found I am undeniably an ancient, and I want to explain why. Are you and I an ancient or a modern? If a better improved hammer or chisel, harder and resistant to dulling blows, was handed to a craftsman, even Christopher Wren was happy with the result. In the old days, a lot of wives died during childbirth, rooms were cold, and not so long ago. Voice and note, but no wireless, no power brakes, no power steering. Would we give up LED lights and air conditioning, safety-equipped cars when our loved ones drive off? Sometimes I flirt with the idea that I actually understand why the old boys codified their local ways into charges and constitution. I actually think that I understand them. I obviously tend to being a bit delusional. It occurred to me that some Freemasons have been happy to innovate by replacing the first local traditions with their own. Yeah, the first. It's a thought I can't get out of my mind. And it is why I must be an ancient, because I'm beginning to see local traditions as unwanted innovations. Changing the first local traditions is changing the ways. Bloody hell. Moderns are everywhere, but being an ancient feels right. The first local traditions were created by early craftsmen. By preserving them, I feel a singular connection that isn't there with local traditions only 20 or 30 or 50 years old. If the modern LTs were a revival of the first local traditions, then I'm good with them. But they aren't. Masonic history still tells the stories and explains the old traditions, and I like that a lot. Modern local traditions is really like printing money with limited value. I'm not going to throw myself on a sword to protect them, but I won't support new local traditions. The older boys aren't around anymore to reclaim their concerns. But some Masons, some Freemasons, are restoring the old walls, setting one stone at a time. There is a need to use the newest tools to keep our lodges in touch, of course. Have at it, but protect the first local traditions and keep the connection alive. So, have I gone off on another tangent here, or do we have something to deal with? Is there something vital in Freemasonry about this? Do you see the point that I'm making? When I realized that, you know, I it's often tongue in cheek. Well, I got a copy of the tongue in cheek. Doesn't work for me so much in Freemasonry anymore. I had a past Grand Master glibly look at me walking up to him to shake his hand, saying, "Oh, are we ready for another philosophical discussion with Dale Graham?" That's the last discussion he's going to have with me, I can tell you that. Because when I'm in the atmosphere of Freemasonry, that's what I do. That's what I do. It's not a dress-up. I can go and do that with my wife and have a nice dinner somewhere else. The sole purpose is around the principles and values of Freemasonry, period. And polite company, period. The rest doesn't appeal to me one iota. I want nothing to do with the other stuff. I had no notion of, you know, when I hear people talk about, you know, the things being a departure from what they expected when they joined. Well, really? Really? Where does that come from? I thought that people came of their own free will and accord and prepared to accept the ways. I'm pretty sure, yeah, that's what you agreed to. That's what you took, that was your oath. So when you get up on your hind legs and start talking about what you came in with your own set of expectations, well, take over, keep walking. We're not losing a Freemason. We're losing somebody that's innovating. I think it's sad, but if you've missed the boat on this one, well, if that's all it is, everything has to remain according to your local tradition instead of the truest ancient local traditions. Well, I don't feel bad about it. I don't like it, but nobody has a right to innovate. And I think we need to get back to those, recognize that. If we're going to make some alteration, then it needs to be weighed against the old ways, not just assumed. And you can see how this happens, if somebody is not a student of the craft and just goes about the business and comes up with an innovation where they don't know that it's an innovation, and they stick to their guns because, you know, the next generation comes in and thinks, well, this must be the way that it's done. You can see how these new local traditions can take root. But always we are able to put these things into context and explain. We need to be able to put words to it and explain what's happened. It's not that everything is bad about the traditions, but if we're going to make an innovation, it needs to be talked about. Certainly our district deputy grand masters have an obligation as officers of the Grand Master, to preserve, not to make any innovation in the work. And does that have to do with the charges? Well, help me here. 1949, Book of the Constitution, the charges are first. 2012, the charges are at the end. What's happened? How did that happen? Just somebody one day looked at it when they're republishing the Constitution and decided that this no longer had a bearing. Did we lose track of why it was the ancient charges were so important? I think that might be the case. I can't rule that out. So that being the case, then they seem to, where else would you put them? You can't put them in the middle. Well, they need to be there because they were there in the 1723 version, weren't they? Prominent, yeah. And prominent in the early days of Freemasonry, where the ritual included, and was, before degrees, the new candidate reading the ancient charges. In other words, here's how we see ourselves, and here's the instruction for you. So you know what to expect when you're around us and when we're in public. Oh, we may have strayed quite far from that day of purity. Remember, I'm not talking about utopia here. Not striving for utopia. But this is not utopian thinking to connect, to begin to understand and discover that the old ways were written out for us and given as an instruction manual, like how to put it together. So you and your mates are going to say, well, we don't need that, the ancient instruction manual around Freemasonry. We've got our own. We've created our own, and it's better. Really? Well, given the choice, I'll go with something that's time-worn, not your innovation, because I don't know what the thinking is behind that. And you're absolutely right. I don't know I can't assume that I understand the thinking in the minds of the ancients that produced the ancient charges. And we're talking about the Cook manuscript going back to a copy from the 15th century. A copy of something that had been written earlier. Does that have as much, is what you're doing have that kind of provenance? No, of course not. And neither does it have the validity. Neither. Can't. Unless we can see the idea of the innovation being connected with the early charges. My goodness, we're quite a distance from that today. And we wonder why the behaviors, why have we shifted our compass point away from the insight and development of Freemasonry, the philosophy, the metaphysics of Freemasonry? Why have we done that? To focus on business side, the governance, and the financial management, organization and bureaucracy. Why has the compass point shifted? Because it's easier. It's easier to do that. It's easier to work at bureaucracy. As we've grown, we've developed a bureaucracy that wasn't there in the first place. And if you're claiming that bureaucracy runs anything, a corrupt bureaucracy brings down organizations. So we do need accountability, but decisions in the hands of bureaucrats is toxic. It's toxic. There's no demons out there. Grow up. Same here is the same thing that is the point of Freemasonry. We each have a responsibility. Too many times we don't exercise that. And so we really are getting our you know, the consequences. We're experiencing the consequences of just the way it was. When you don't do anything and our brethren before us haven't done anything, then these lodges that function more fully seem to take on almost a mythological character. You know, the lodge where if a visitor comes to the door, before he's admitted, everybody in the lodge is given an opportunity to say whether he'll come in or not. And if one in the lodge says no, then so be it. No questions asked. No questions asked. So, do we have choices? Yeah. And I'm deathly afraid of these, you know, seismic kinds of changes. I don't like them. I think they're bad for any kind of an organization. We need thoughtful change. Very thoughtful change. Where we can come at the issues maybe even sideways. Maybe sideways is the way to think of it. It may be the safest way to preserve the harmony. Sulking isn't disturbing harmony. Sulking is when a man is embarrassing himself. Bit of a temper. To those of you who feel that, you know, there's silliness around the lodge, well, you don't have to, you know, break the back of the camel. Just move on. Go other places. Vote with your feet. If you're asked your opinion, you can always give it when a master asks. Well, when people are allowed to get away with things and they can act in lodge with impunity, like the old man that used to, old fellow, he was given a great deal of respect because he'd been a Mason forever, he's well into his 90s. But he would bring the most vulgar joke to lodge. And I felt very sorry. It was like all of a sudden, instead of laughing with him about this vulgarity, it was like everybody's laughing at him. All the rolled eyes and saying, oh, you have to endure this. This 10-minute soliloquy of vulgarity. And, you know, it was that uncomfortable laughter. But nobody able to say, you know, oh boy, you've gone off a bit. This isn't what Freemasonry is about. Strange times we live in. Yes, of course. We had... I need to talk to you about some... So give me some advice. Give me some advice about the ancients and moderns. Please. Please. We talked a little bit. How about a little bit about the Freemasonry in Canada in the early days? Is that you've got a little bit of a... Can we handle a little bit of that? This is very, very early period that I'm talking about. Yeah. This is going back. We've already talked about this a little bit a couple of weeks ago. So I want to talk about Freemasonry in Ontario and back in the time of Most Worshipful Brother John S. Martin. He was way back. It's funny. It's odd, ridicule to think about. Think about the days of old when people would associate esotericism and maybe the occult with the Masonic Order. Really, it's striking that we hear people defining Freemasonry as a Christian organization, even though it was never intended to be that. We can't stop people from being loose cannons, saying things that are wrong. Well, either they don't care or they're misguided. I tend to think that it's a matter of the second, that they're a brother, and so they're just misguided. It's a bitter pill to swallow to think that somebody just doesn't care about the effect of what he's saying on other people. In my neighborhood, we refer to that as stupidity. I just have some material here you might find interesting by Augustus T. Freed. He used to happen to be the past Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of Canada in Ontario. So, I have the privilege of reading the preceding excellent article written by Brother George J. Bennett on the early history of Freemasonry in Canada, he said, and on the formation of the Grand Lodge. Hence, I do not propose to tread the path traversed by him, but shall endeavor to supplement his narrative with some accounts of lodges warranted in the early days of Masonry in that part of Canada, formerly called Upper Canada or Canada West, and now forming the province of Ontario. Right Worshipful Brother William Jarvis, who was appointed, as in Jarvis Street, who was appointed to the civil position of the Provincial Secretary of Upper Canada in 1792, was at the same time made Provincial Grand Master of Masons. And between the year named and 1817, he issued warrants to 24 lodges. Some of these continue to the present time, but most of them have fallen on sleep. Four of the old Jarvis lodges have, by resolutions of Grand Lodge, been permitted to wear gold lace on their aprons and to work with gold jewels in recognition of their rank in the craft and their service in Masonry in this jurisdiction. These are now known as Niagara Lodge No. 2, the ancient St. John's No. 3 of Kingston, Sussex No. 5 of Brockville, and the Barton No. 6 of Hamilton. Niagara Lodge No. 2 was the first warranted by Jarvis. It has experienced many vicissitudes, and for a number of years its meetings were interrupted. But it has survived all blows of time and chance and is now a prosperous and active body. The town of Niagara, formerly called Newark, was burned by the troops of the United States in the War of 1812. When the lodge room and all the original records were destroyed, though the warrant was saved and hangs in the wall of the present lodge room. In June 1814, while the United States troops were still in possession of Niagara, Lieutenant Fitzgibbon, with a small body of British Rangers, was stationed at DeCue's house, a few miles south of St. Catharines, and was the cause of a great deal of annoyance to the invading force. General Dearborn therefore decided to capture him, or at least to dislodge him, and sent Colonel Boistler, commanding the 14th Regiment of United States Regulars, with other troops, to do the work. Mrs. Laura Secord, wife of a Mason, accidentally learned of the proposed expedition and determined to give warning to Lieutenant Fitzgibbon. Accordingly, taking a pail in her hand, as if about to go out to milk her cows, she passed the sentries and made her way for 19 miles through woods swarming with Indians, till she reached the DeCue house and warned the lieutenant of his danger. It is not probable that the action of Mrs. Secord had any bearing upon the subsequent engagement of the Indians under command of Captain W.J. Kerr, were watching the movements of Colonel Borster. They fought the Battle of Beaver Dams, and before the regulars under Lieutenant Fitzgibbon arrived on the field, the United States troops were beaten to a standstill. Lieutenant Fitzgibbon succeeded in persuading Colonel Borstel that he was surrounded by a vastly superior force of Indians and British regulars, and the colonel surrendered his whole force. Brother Secord was not a member of Niagara Lodge, but of a lodge that met at Stamford, near Niagara Falls. In 1826, William Morgan was abducted from Batavia, New York, and taken to Fort Niagara on the New York side, where he was temporarily placed over to the Canadian side of the river and endeavored to secure the cooperation of the Niagara Brethren in disposing of the prisoner. There are several accounts, no one of them trustworthy, of subsequent events. One of them, that the abductors killed Morgan in the magazine of the fort, sewed the body in a sack, carried it to a boat, rowed out into the river and sunk it. The next is that, failing to get assistance from the Canadian Masons, they returned to Fort Niagara and found that Morgan had died from dissipation, exposure, and fright. A third, that they took Morgan still alive into the boat, weighed him with irons, and threw him overboard. And the fourth is that the Canadian Masons did receive him and passed him on to Toronto, near which place he lived for a number of years. I have conversed with a number of the oldest Masons in Niagara on the subject, and they agree in the assertion that the Brethren of the Lodge refused to have any hand in the business. Well, they also think that Morgan was passed on toward Hamilton and lived for some years on the north shore of Lake Ontario. The lodge room was destroyed by fire in 1860, and all the old documents, together with the jewels and other property of the lodge, were burned. The building, now owned and occupied, stands in the site of what in which the lodge first met, and in which the provincial Grand Lodge formed by Jarvis held its meeting. The ancient St. John's Lodge of Kingston, number 3, on the present register of the Grand Lodge of Canada, number 6, was number 6 of the lodges warranted by William Jarvis. It worked for a short time under dispensation, and its warrant was dated the 20th of November, 1795. This lodge has always held a prominent place in the Masonry of Ontario, has always exercised great influence in Masonic circles, and yet there is little in its record which has more than local interest. It is remarkable, rather, that the number of prominent men who were initiated in it than for events of magnitude in its history. One of the charter members was Richard Cartwright, the great-grandfather of Sir Richard Cartwright, who for half a century took a leading part in the political history of the country and was, from September 30th, 1904, to the time of his death, a senator of Canada. Other members of ancient St. John's who have made names for themselves excuse me. My tongue's sweating. Other members of ancient St. John's who have made names for themselves in the history of Canada were Sir Alexander Campbell, William Henry Draper, Sir Henry Smith, and Sir John A. Macdonald, for many years Premier of Canada. In 1834, owing to the anti-Masonic excitement in the United States, the Brethren deemed it prudent to cease working until such time as the lodge might beneficially work with advantage to the craft and the world at large. The meetings were not resumed for 9 years, until 1834. That's a courtesy. That's a cautious group. Sussex Lodge number 5 was originally formed in a regiment raised by the Royal Service by Sir John Johnson during the Revolutionary War. Its first warrant was issued by the Grand Lodge of New York in 1783 to, quote, a lodge in His Majesty's Loyal American Regiment. Soon after the close of the war, many members of the regiment settled on the north side of the St. Lawrence near the present town of Prescott. And they appear to have carried the lodge organization with them. There, it was called the New Oswegatchie Lodge. Oswegatchie was the old name of Ogdensburg, New York. About 1790, a warrant appears to have been obtained from the Provincial Grand Lodge of Quebec. The early minutes of the lodge are full and are of value as showing the character of masonry which existed in those days. But they have little interest for the general reader. At later dates, the lodge worked under warrants from the Provincial Grand Lodge of Ancients of Upper Canada. Yippee! Me and the boys. Then from Provincial Grand Lodges under the United Grand Lodge of England. I'm going to read that a second time, eh? At later dates, the lodge worked under warrants from the Provincial Grand Lodge of Ancients of Upper Canada. Then from Provincial Grand Lodges under the United Grand Lodge of England. It was not called Sussex Lodge until 1822. It was the first named on the list of lodges which met at Hamilton in 1855 to perform the Grand Lodge of Canada. W.B. Simpson, a past master of the lodge, was active in the work of organization and was elected the first district deputy grand master of the Central District. W.B. Simpson was elected Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of Canada in 1864 and served with eminent ability for 2 years. Another valuable and prominent member of the lodge was Right Worshipful Brother Zimba M. Phillips. He was president of a convention held in Kingston in 1820, which promoted the revival of masonry in Canada West in 1822. And was a power in the craft until the time of his death. The Barton Lodge, number 6 on the register of the Grand Lodge of Canada, was the 9th of those warranted by William Jarvis. Its charter was dated November 20th, 1795. The document cannot now be found, but the receipt for the charter fee is preserved, dated November 1795. And Lane's Masonic Record in English says the date of the original warrant was the 20th of November, 1795. The first members were men who were called in Canada United Empire Loyalists. They had lived in various parts of the country now forming the United States, had adhered to the royal cause in the War of the Revolution. And at the end of the struggle, they were deprived of their property and compelled to seek new homes in the then almost unbroken wilderness of Upper Canada. Those who settled on or near the spot on which Hamilton now stands put down stakes in the forest, for the land was not surveyed, and started life anew. Among these pioneers came Davenport Phelps, a missionary sent out under the auspices of Trinity Church, New York. He was also a notary public and withal Grand Secretary of the Provincial Grand Lodge of Upper Canada, of which William Jarvis was Provincial Grand Master. Several of the settlers at the head of the lake, as the country at the west extremity of Lake Ontario was then called, were Masons, and when Davenport Phelps came among them, he apparently found no difficulty in gathering them together in a Masonic fold. Of Robert Land, one of the founders of the lodge, the following story is told. He was a farmer living in southern New York near the Pennsylvania line. While absent from his regiment, Indian allies of the colonel's, they raided the settlement, burned the houses, and killed and carried off all the inhabitants, mostly women and children. Land returned from service, found his home a heap of ashes, and was told his wife and 2 children had been killed. Heartbroken, he returned to his regiment, and at the close of the war went to Canada and was given a tract of land at the head of the lake, that being off of Lake Ontario, the western extremity of Lake Ontario. The wife and children, however, had not been killed, but were rescued by British troops and taken to New York. Thence, they were sent by sea to Halifax, and there they remained for some years. Of course, in time, information reached Mrs. Land that her husband was living at the head of the lake, and she was sent to that place by the military authorities of Nova Scotia. As Robert Land sat in the door of his cabin one summer evening, he saw a woman and two boys approaching. They proved to be his wife and sons, and the long divided family was united. The minutes of the earliest meetings of the lodge were kept on loose sheets of paper and are lost. The first which now exist are those of a meeting held the January 31st, 1796, which was attended by 12 members and 4 visitors. Among the members appears the name of Brother Captain Brant. This was Thayendanegea, the celebrated Indian chief. He lived about 10 miles from the meeting place of the lodge on a square mile of land given him by the British government. There is no other evidence that this record to show that he was a member of the lodge. But the old minutes are very interesting, and showing the customs of the time and illustrating the condition of the country, they have no great interest for the general reader. We read in one place that the treasurer takes as much money out of the chest as will purchase 3 gallons of whiskey against the next lodge night. Pay attention here, secretaries. I think I'm just convinced myself I am an ancient. I'll read that again. The treasurer, one of these notes, we read in one place, the treasurer takes as much money out of the chest as will purchase 3 gallons of whiskey against the next lodge night. And in another place, that the liquors used for the use of the lodge shall be purchased with the money belonging to the lodge by the barrel or quarter cask. Here. So we have no doubt that when the brethren were called from labor to refreshment, as they were several times in the course of the evening, the phrase used was no mere figure of speech. Again, when we read that brethren were permitted to pay their annual dues in good merchantable wheat delivered at Brother Rousseau's mill, we need no further intimation that at the end of the 18th century, cash was a scarce article at the head of the lake. The end of the 18th century, that's the start of the 19th century. Another entry is of wider interest and exhibits a broader spirit. I may be pardoned for copying the minute in full. From the lodge that met the 12th of December 1800, the secretary read a letter from the Grand Secretary informing the lodge of a communication received from the Grand Lodge of Pennsylvania, announcing the death of the Right Worshipful Grand Master Washington, and requesting this lodge to go in mourning at their public and private meetings 6 months, including their first meeting, in consequence of which Brother Aikman moved, seconded by Brother J. Showers, that a piece of black ribbon should be purchased for that purpose. The motion being put was carried. Brother John Lottridge agreed to furnish the lodge with ribbon. Let it not be forgotten that a large majority of the members of the Barton Lodge at that time were men who had fought on the Royalist side in the War of the Revolution, and they had lost their property and had been exiled from the place of their birth because of the part they had taken. Notwithstanding which, they could rise above the passions of the conflict and resentment of that place. They must have believed to be injustice and spoliation, and could remember as Masons the brother who was so eminently worthy of honor. A few years later, war broke out between Great Britain, the United States, and Upper Canada was several times invaded by the forces of the Republic. Man. We'll come back, eh? The Barton, members of the Barton, did their share of work in several battles which took place along the Niagara frontier and further west. And in 1813, a strong force under Generals Winder and Chandler advanced from Niagara against the British General Vincent, who was entrenched at Burlington Heights in the western part of what is now Hamilton. We have got to come back and deal with it. So, are you beginning to piece it together? No, we weren't stupid. No, we weren't just a men without purpose. What we don't hear about, though, you notice? Nothing about the education that went on. Even today, when you look at the minutes of the secretary's minutes, very little, they contain very, very little, which has often made me wonder, why bother? Why bother? Very little of even local interest, let alone general interest, as the Grand Master was quick to point out. Anyway, help me understand if you were an ancient or a modern. You can get in touch with me through MasonicCompanion@gmail.com. And I'm working on a list of guest speakers coming up. Yeah, the long-awaited guest speaker list. Only I'm trying to connect with some fellows out in Cornish, England. Down in the south, you know, the southern western tip, you know, where those nice chalk cliffs go out into the ocean. Just because we celebrated a couple of weeks ago, mentioned that they had an installation, and we offered our sentiment and best wishes. So let's see what else we can do. I hope in the meantime. I look forward to seeing you. I'm off to a play next week, Shakespeare, at Stratford, here in Ontario. One that I had seen in rehearsal at the Globe Theatre in London when my wife and I were there 2 years ago, Midsummer Night's Dream. So I'm very much looking forward to that, and I'll try and talk to you, and maybe I'll try and pick up a word. Shakespeare invented words. It's hard to believe. So I hope that you walk with the great architect of the universe by your side, that you feel inspired by the principles of Freemasonry to see the world as it really is, that there is a physic and a metaphysic, a deeper understanding that only you can discover. But let's try and encourage that belief by our own behavior. I look forward to our next opportunity together. And in the meantime, it's been an absolute pleasure.